Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Overthrows podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, who you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find literally everywhere. And New Zealand have become the fourth team in the history of women's cricket to win the T20 World Cup, after, of course, Australia, England and the West Indies. And, you know, a comprehensive victory in the end, Jared, 32 runs. And what a
Smashed
day
him.
This...
Yeah, Smashed him.
What a day this has been for New Zealand cricket, right? The women go on and win the T20 World Cup and the men win a test match in India. So that really is a phenomenal day for New Zealand cricket.
It is. I mean, let's just we can obviously talk about the other one as well, but just on the women, you know, what was it, 10 losses in a row,
yes,
or whatever,
it was.
Coming into the tournament?
We were at that point. I remember it was 10 straight losses coming into the tournament. And I remember when people would ask me, what do you think Pakistan will do? I was like, they'll win a game and probably New Zealand, right? And it's just been that kind of a tournament. They didn't even beat Australia and they are crowned world champions, right? It's been a freakish T20 World Cup and a fitting end to it.
Just I mean, craziness, right? Like it's such a big moment for them. I think I said on the podcast the other day that they hadn't won a World Cup before. They hadn't won a T20 World Cup, but I was very tired when we did that show the other day. But this is in the professional era of women's cricket.
Yeah.
This is their biggest win, right? And it's absolutely huge. I don't know if you saw, did you see, I think it was the second last ball, when the ball went out to Susie Bates and the camera went on her.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just smiling like, I mean, it just, for me, like, it was such a great moment. She's been one of my favorite cricketers for a long time. Obviously, you know, interviewed her a couple of times and she's been on the podcast. And, she, you know, I love talking cricket with her. Like, I remember when we did the podcast, she's just one of those players that I just love talking cricket with. And, you know, so I'm watching her do that and you're just like, oh my God, she never thought she'd be there. And then the other moment when Sophie Devine is in tears and they meet up and you're just like, think about everything that has led to that moment for them. So they're both in their mid-30s, late 30s for
late
one
30s.
Of them. Yeah. Mid-30s for Sophie, I think. Late-30s for Susie. They came in when New Zealand was good, right?
Yeah.
When they start playing cricket, New Zealand is a really good team. New Zealand's in the top three teams in the world. They're regularly in World Cup finals. People think that this is a side. And then these are two young stars who obviously, you know, play brilliant cricket. And the team just sort of slowly just kind of decays and everyone else leapfrogs them. Like everywhere is leapfrogging them. And you know, you even get situations where, you know, random other cricket teams are playing test matches and they don't get any test matches. They don't get the professional support. I think New Zealand cricket's done some good things with women, but they don't get the kind of professional support that other leagues have been able to, other countries have been able to do. You know, we've seen India go from nowhere to being way better than them. We've seen West Indies and South Africa go from beneath them to above them.
Yeah.
And these are the two players that have been the most important players in that whole period. And just watching them come together, it's like, I don't think I ever asked Susie about this because I spent a lot of time talking to her about Test cricket. But the reason I didn't ask her like what it would be like to not win a World Cup is because it never occurred to me that they would be in another position to get that close to not win a World Cup, right? And you watch the two senior players come together and it looks like two people who just cannot believe that their dreams have come true, right? And Eek was next to me. Eek watched the whole game. He was absolutely obsessed with the whole game. And I was like, this is why we watch.
Yeah.
When Sophie and Susie come together, this is why we watch. And I wouldn't have felt any different if it was Marizan Kapp, who obviously is, again, one of my favorite players in the world. But it was just watching them do that, and you're like, they didn't expect to be there, right? They didn't expect this to happen. And it couldn't happen to two more deserving players. Just absolutely brilliant.
Absolutely. It was one of those Mahela Sangha, Virat Rohit moments, you know, that embrace between Sophie Devine and Susie Bates. Of course, Sophie kind of set the tone for them at the start of this World Cup with that knock versus India. As you mentioned, she's 35 years of age, so, you know, definitely towards the, or currently in the twilight of her career. And Susie Bates, you were telling me, she nearly retired a couple of years back, right? And she is the most capped player in women's T20 internationals at 37 years of age, top scorer for New Zealand in this tournament with the bat. And also she gave them the start in the power play today, right? That was where they got that initial, they won that initial battle when they really went for it in the power play.
So I just done a video for the main channel, which you'll be up. We just put a video up about New Zealand beating India in the test match and now we're going to do this as well. So it's all New Zealand all the time here on the Good Areas Network. but you know, I've just done the video on this and are you a boxing fan? I don't know if we've ever talked about this before.
I've watched a couple of documentaries. That's about it.
Have you ever seen the one? Oh my god, I forgot the name of it. When We Were Kings.
No.
So When We Were Kings is all about the Rumble in the Jungle, and I've watched lots of documentaries about the Rumble in the Jungle because it's such a fascinating thing. But that film's obviously brilliant. But one of the sporting things, and one of the reasons I always loved that film as a kid, was because of the sport side of it. They really show you in a way that most sports documentaries never do. They really show you what Muhammad Ali did. And he basically, he faked out George Foreman. And he did a lot of practice where he was moving slowly around the ring and everything and was getting hit. And everyone was like, oh, okay, maybe he's not as quick anymore. How's he going to beat Foreman? And he gets out in the first fight and he just throws a bunch of right-hand leads. And for anyone who doesn't understand boxing, a right-hand lead means that you're basically not protecting yourself at all. And professionals don't throw right-hand leads. And the reason they don't throw right-hand leads, Bayram, is because they can go horribly wrong, right? Uh-huh. And George Foreman was not expecting a bunch of right-hand leads to come his way. And so Ali hits him a bunch of different ways. And it completely changes the fight because everyone thought that Foreman was going to be the aggressor. And suddenly Ali was. And New Zealand, I mean, I'd done a podcast with Jeremy Coney and Dan McCarty, and we talked about it. They'd been batting slow. Right, all the way through this tournament, they'd been batting slow. I thought if that game against Pakistan was a normal game, I think Pakistan might have beaten them. Yep. I thought they didn't score enough runs against the West Indies. Their bowling has been pulling them back again and again. And even against the Australian game, I think their bowling gave them much bigger chance in that game than they probably deserved, even if their batting didn't go up against it. You know, bowled brilliantly against India, you know. So again and again, their bowling has been pulling them back. And they're just like, I think what we're going to do right here is we're just going to go nuts. And it wasn't like they scored at like 9 runs and over or anything, but it was very clear that they were not going to end up like, or they were not going to let South Africa settle at all. They were going to come at them as hard as possible. And South Africa changed all their plans within about 3 overs because of how hard they came at them. And it's a hugely risky thing to do in a World Cup. And just I think on they that, thought to themselves.
Just on the hugely risky part, when, of course, Laura Wolvart won the toss, she elected to field first. And New Zealand had been doing well defending total. South Africa had been a good chasing side. But, you know, generally in a big final, you'd probably want runs on the board, which is what, you know, the New Zealand skipper said as well after losing the toss.
But usually if you're worried about that sort of runs on the board style, you chip it around a bit more, right?
Yeah.
You try and get yourself into a position where maybe you can slog the last 10 overs and put some pressure and hope that South Africa falls apart. They didn't do that. And Susie Bates, in the end, ends up with a runner ball score. So it doesn't look like she went particularly fast. And Georgia Plimmer, I can't remember what her strike rate was.
She came out attacking. She was a bit quicker, wasn't she? Yeah, yeah. She struck a couple of beautiful fours and then she got out. But, you know, you speak
They actually played more shots than they did score quick. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you watched it, you were like, what the hell are they doing? And then you looked at the score and you're like, it hasn't translated yet, but it put pressure back on.
Yeah, no, definitely, you know, the intent was there. You could see that New Zealand are really going for it. And if you look at their entire batting innings in phases, right, the power play is where Plimmer gets a few boundaries and Susie Bates does well, and they score 43 for one. And then there are 70 for two in 10 overs. At that point, you're like, okay, maybe South Africa have a way back into this fixture. And then in the next 5 overs, 40 runs are scored. That's when Brooke Halliday really went for it. And then in the end, Amelia Kerr, you know, kind of took them all the way. And Green, both those two scored like what? 40, 48 runs in the last 5 overs. And all of a sudden...
Well, what was the last over? Was it 15, 18? I don't know.
Something like that.
And that was the point. If you go back, Malaba bowled well, but never really dominated the way that she has been in this tournament.
I mean, she took 2 wickets, but then again, you see that over that she bowled to Amelia Kerr, and she went back to back, right? One was a heave, and then the other one was in a 4-over extra cover. That was like really a stamp of authority right over there.
Yeah, I think she took the wickets, but she didn't change the game with her wickets. And that's not her fault. Like, she still bowled well. But she didn't dominate. We've seen her dominate in other games. Marizan Kapp, they had to yank her around, and it wasn't just her fault, but they weren't sure what to do with her. And who bowled the death over, the last over? Who's their other good bowler?
Ayabonga Kaka.
Yeah, Ayabonga Kaka just lost it.
Yep.
Right?
She had a terrible
completely lost it. Mm. And there's a really interesting 7-ball period there where de Klerk is at long off. And the ball is hit hard, but she should stop it. She misses it, and it goes for it to the boundary. And then the next over, she has a shocker. And that was that period that you're talking about where they just upped it, and Halliday went, and then they went nuts at the end. But let's be honest, South Africa bowled wides. South Africa kept changing their bowling plans because they didn't know, they just didn't feel comfortable against New Zealand at any stage. Fielding wasn't dreadful, but their fielding wasn't brilliant either. I know they dropped one catch, but that was, I think, towards the end.
That was the last ball. The drop catch was the last ball. But
yeah, it was the last ball. I thought it was second last.
I don't think the ground fielding was great. They caught well otherwise, but there were like two or three fours that they really should have stopped, right? It was really, really
There was an early one, wasn't there, that was parried that should have been stopped early on. And then there was the one from De Klerk, and there was another one out on another boundary that they should have stopped. So I'm with you. I don't think their ground fielding was great, but they're catching, you know... was incredible. But just this comment from Caushal, who says, the greatest day in New Zealand cricket history. It kind of has to be up there, doesn't it? I mean, winning the World Test Championship is probably the other. I know winning in England and Australia for the first time was pretty big. Winning in 1969, when for 39 years they never won a Test series. But the fact that they've won a World Cup on the same day that they've beaten probably their biggest nemesis in Test cricket as well is just absolutely huge. So,
It's phenomenal, really. And over here, Varun has a quote from Abhishek Mukherjee, who's saying, Bruce Murray played 13 tests for New Zealand. He quit because he did not want to play on Sundays, which he liked to devote to the church and his family. Well,
there's a reason. Keep reading.
Oh, his granddaughter Amelia Kerr was named the player of the match in the final and the player of the tournament as New Zealand won the World Cup on a Sunday. That is insane.
Yep. So Bruce Murray is, I only found this out recently that I didn't realize Amelia Kerr, but this is one of the things that I don't think, when I first started covering women's cricket, it was, it's not a real sport and all that sort of nonsense that you got. And then you see Amelia Kerr, who is literally from a cricket family. I think her, I think other relatives in her family played. I don't know if they played, they didn't play test cricket, but I think they played first class cricket or they played top level grade cricket. Like, she is a child of cricket, right? And to see her with the talent that she's had and her form of recent times hasn't been.
It's been dreadful. It's been absolutely dreadful. New Zealand weren't doing well because that top three or those three big players in Devine, Bates and Kerr weren't performing.
Bates hasn't batted well this tournament. And Sophie Devine had that one great knock against India, which obviously in the end has probably got them to this stage. Yep. But she hadn't had a great tournament either. So, those three players really stood up. And then just to go through all the youngsters as well. Like,
I mean, so many.
There's so many players in that team that, you know, we'll get back to Plimmer. Plimmer's the one during the England series that I was just like, I think I was betting on her to be out under 10 in almost every game, right? Like, it was just like, she just looked all over the place. Her technique wasn't there. She was slogging and she wasn't slogging well. And it was really messy. And in this World Cup, I talked to Jeremy Coney about it and he's like, you can just see she straightened up.
Yeah.
She just looks like in the last month or so, someone has said to her, we want you to be aggressive, but we want you to play straight when you're being aggressive, right? And she'll still play the odd crossbat shot. She got away with one again today. But if she plays the majority of it, because she hits the ball really hard. It's absolutely incredible.
I didn't know much about her.
Stepped up.
Right? Georgia Plimmer.
That's because she hadn't made any runs.
Exactly. It wasn't a name or cricketer I was really familiar with, but in this World Cup, I've been really impressed because she's given them starts. You know, Susie Bates didn't be that or wasn't that aggressor in the power play ever for them. But Georgia Plimmer did, you know, at times, you know, take bowlers on. And she scored as many runs as Susie Bates as well, 150 for both of them. But her strike rate is around 120. I think it's 119. She was a performer, right? You have to talk about Rosemary Mayer as well. Took a threefer in the final and she's been good mostly all tournament. Eden Carson was great against India, was great in the semi-final. And you talk about that moment when they showed Susie Bates before on the penultimate delivery. That final delivery, they zoomed in on Eden Carson as well. And she was just over the moon at that point, right?
Yeah.
Brooke Halliday, a very, very noteworthy performances. You talk about Leah Tahuhu, who brought her experience, right? She was there.
And let's talk about her. I know, Leah Tahuhu, I remember... She was probably one of the first women bowlers who had a proper bouncer. Mm-hmm. Like, she was genuinely quick. I remember seeing her bowl at Docklands one day. I think she was playing for the Renegades or against the Renegades anyway. Mm. And she was just storming in. And I was like, that's heat, right? Yeah. And she's not that player anymore. She's basically gone from, you know, she's basically, well, I put this in my group today with some of my friends. I said, I can't wait for Leah Plunkett to bowl. Because she's basically bowling Liam Plunkett over. She's gone from a proper opening bowler speed demon to the... She just comes in, she whacks him into the pitch. And she, I don't know if you saw later on, like after they won, she just had the handkerchief on her face because there were so many tears. She didn't actually know how to control it. I just want this message from Ronald's great. So I knew that Emilio Kerr's family was from cricket, but he's given us all the details here. Yep. He says that Kerr is third generation Wellington representative. So I thought that was right, but I didn't want to say it in case I was wrong. Her grandfather, her mother, her father, her sister and herself, and her partner also plays for Wellington. When I say she is a child of cricket, like, it is important to know that she is, and that is the difference, right? We are now seeing women growing up as if cricket is a normal thing, and she has been a star from a very young age, as we said recently, slipped back a little bit, although if you're going to slip back and then win your team a tournament at a World Cup, I think New Zealand would take that.
Yeah.
But she is, that is the difference. Women now are being brought up in that kind of environment and encouraged in a way that, you know, without wanting to slam the Grace family, WG Grace, he didn't want his daughter playing cricket, right? Like, things have changed so much and you see things like this. It's incredible.
Thanks to NVplay's Data Insights for helping me with this video. They can help any cricket team improve their skills using their advanced technology.
I mean, just on Emilia Kerr, we've talked about everyone, but we haven't really touched on her. She gave me my favorite moments in the final. I've already talked about that back-to-back four sequence versus Malaba, the heave and the one over extra cover. But it was that over that she bowled in which she first caught Laura Wolfart and then Aneka Bosch. So you've got the leading run scorer of the tournament and the hero of the semi-final who absolutely obliterated Australia in the same goddamn over. That was game, set, final for me there and then. What a performance.
Yeah, I don't think Aneka Bosch actually hit her ball. I think that was a rogue noise. But anyway, it comes on the back of the Leah's over, right? The Liam Plunkett over, just whacking it in. And did that over go for like one run or two runs or something?
Yeah, something. Aneka Bosch was like 5 of 5, and then she was like 5 of 9 or 5 of 10, something like that.
They were almost favorites at that point. Like, and we, you know, I was looking for Jew and you know, I think they started the innings at about 3.7, 4.2, and they'd come in to pretty much even money with New Zealand. That over comes in. And as you said, if you remember the over before that, Emilia Kerr's first over, she was limping.
Yes.
It wasn't a good over. Mm-hmm. She dragged the ball down. She put no pressure on. And I was thinking at that stage, if they can't get 2 wickets out of Emilia Kerr and 2 important wickets out of Emilia Kerr, specifically Laura Wolfart, I was like, this game's gone. And they will run away with it because of the pace that the South Africans can score with. Like, Marazan hadn't come in at that stage. They still had de Klerk to slog a few. I know Tyrone hadn't hit the ball off the square all tournament, but we're assuming eventually she would. So they had power to come as well.
She did hit a 4 down the ground. I can remember one by Tryon.
Was that today?
Yes. I'm pretty sure she
did. Yeah. That was her first 4 in the tournament, I think you'll find.
Was it?
I'm pretty sure.
Ian Bishop kept saying that she does have some shots, but she can only do it on her best day. I'm paraphrasing, of course, but he kept
I've seen
that.
Her smack the ball before, but this tournament, she's been ordinary. There was two. I'm pretty sure those are the two fun facts. Chloe hadn't hit a 4 yet, and the wicketkeeper, oh my God, I've forgotten her name. The South African wicketkeeper hadn't batted in this tournament yet.
Yeah.
So those are the two fun facts that I had in my head. Anyway, so you know Emilia Kerr, I was like, if they don't get wickets out of her, they need a South African, you know, collapse due to pressure, right? That was the only other chance. Mm-hmm. And straight away after that Tuhuhu over, she comes on and she gets Laura Wolfart. And for me, I know you think the double strike, but for me, once Laura Wolfart was out, because I thought Laura Wolfart on that pitch could score 65 off 50. Right, without really doing anything outlandish, which allowed the rest of the players to just whack as much as they want. And you only need one player to come off and you win. Once she was gone, you needed Bosch to go back to back, which, considering she'd never batted like she had in the last game, was optimistic. And then you needed a bunch of players to stay with Marazan cap. Right?
The word you're looking for is banished now in cricket terminology, but the word you're looking for is anchor. Laura Wolfart is the anchor.
I think in that kind of chase, she'd be absolute. I mean, she is an anchor, right? Like, I know she can smack some sixes and was it against Darcy Brown where she launched her back over her head for 6?
Yeah.
I think she could actually back more exciting. But in this side and in that kind of chase, that's what you wanted from her, right? And if she kicked on later on, you would take the better strike rate, but you didn't need the better strike rate. You needed someone in that top 4 to probably go on and make 50, 55, 60, 65 to allow the others to come in and just go whack and hope that one of them comes off. Because it was, they were, what, 15 runs above par, I would say. And absolutely, that's about how many wides, no balls South Africa bowled, by the way.
Absolutely, yeah. So South Africa fielded poorly, the ground fielding at least, not the catching, even though they just dropped one at the end. But I feel like the wides and the no balls in particular, they came at the worst possible times. Every time there was a no ball, a few, like I remember one in which the free hit was also capitalized on, right? And it was really indisciplined from South Africa. But coming to their batting for a bit, right? When they started, I mean, Tasman Brits and Laura Wolvart were the highest run scorers, but they really, you know, started to take New Zealand's bowlers on as well. And, you know, the Wolf is really good at finding gaps. There was this one shot that she kind of struck a full toss through extra, right? Kind of just muscled it in a way. I felt like, okay, today's definitely her day. And they were, what, 47? 47 for no loss after the power play. And I was like, okay, well, and originally, I thought 159 runs can't be chased over here, but maybe South Africa will prove me wrong. So it really is that over. And you're right, the Wolvart wicket is definitely bigger than the Aneka Bosch wicket. But those were the moments that will be written down in the history books, right?
Yeah.
Amelia Kerr has basically done a, I don't even know, she's done an Afridi in a way. You know, because she's absolutely kind of made this T20 World Cup her own. She got 15 wickets, leading wicket taker of the tournament. We all thought Sophie Eccleston, Radha Yadav, who didn't even get to play as much, actually. Some people had Sadia Iqbal as well because she was doing really well. And Amelia Kerr goes on and takes 15 wickets in 22.4 overs. That's insane. I mean, that's crazy.
I remember the Australia game, and it's weird because that's the only game they've ended up losing, hasn't it?
Yeah.
But that's the Australian game where she, and I, because she's a leggy, you know, I take more of an interest in her than other cricketers. And I watched her wrongen, and I was just like, she bowled two back-to-back wrongens and took two wickets in that game. But she pitched them in exactly the right place where you want, basically the Rashid Khan line and length, right? Where the batter can't tell from where the ball has been pitched if it's going to spin in or spin away. And they didn't pick it. And I'm like, these Australian women play a lot of leg spin, and they played a lot of Amelia Kerr. She just looked like, I don't know whether she'd worked on her bowling a little bit or she knew coming into the UAE or whatever that may be, but she just amped up. And yeah, Varun put this up on our group of, you know, she's by far and away the best bowler in this tournament. So she took 1.4 wickets more than you would expect in her four overs, and she was 1.5 runs better per over. I mean,
That's insane.
Absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, you know, she is a super talented player. We all know that. But the way she's just gone on completely owned this tournament, with the ball, of course, leading wicket taker. She's back player of the final, player of the tournament. She was cramping all the while, and yet she's ended up with 43 runs with the bat and 3 for 24 with the ball. It is a goated performance, and one that we'll remember this final by. But, you know, just like, you mentioned South Africa's fielding and the indiscipline with the ball, wides and no balls. That same thing, if you look at New Zealand, is not there. New Zealand caught brilliant. Like, brilliantly is not strong enough an adjective. They were phenomenal, right? Spectacular. They didn't drop a single catch. Susie Bates
was... They dropped the catch when the game was over and there was the two of them running in together.
Yes.
But to be honest, it was like at that stage, it didn't matter anyway. But yet, but you're right. They didn't drop a catch when it counted. I think they bowled three wides in the first over, didn't they? And I was like, oh my God, they're not going to do what South Africa's done. They're not going to give 10 runs back. And they did bowl a couple of wides. But again, I think early in the over, it was just swinging so much, she couldn't control the ball. But you're right. They were just much more disciplined. Yeah. You know, there was a fielding moment when they went around and they saved one on the boundary and she slaps it. I can't remember who the two fielders were, but she slaps it as it's going out of bounds to the other player.
Yes, I remember that one.
You know, just little things like that. And I think Ejaz has put up a comment a couple, Varun's put up Ejaz's comment a couple of times about, is this the best game in terms of catching throughout this tournament? There's actually been some really good catching in some of the day games. It's the night games that have, so when there were day games, and obviously games with Australia had a higher level of fielding than anything else. But he's right. I think this was the best catching game we probably had seen maybe all the way through, or at least in a while.
It's interesting how it came in a final when generally the nerves are up and you might even drop a few more. But it was really a phenomenal, you know, catching game and fielding game overall. It was in stark contrast to the rest of the tournament, you know, because it has been a poor fielding tournament. But yeah, I mean, I suppose that New Zealand cricket fans should go and, you know, open a tab in the bar, get everyone, you know, a couple of rounds, because this is insane. It's, like, these two things.
So you're aware. Just so you're aware, Bayram, it's 7:40 a.m. in the morning there.
They'll wake up and they'll start drinking early. But you know, get both of these things, if you think about New Zealand winning a test match in India and New Zealand winning the T20 World Cup, someone who put a parlay bet on that probably doesn't need to do anything for the rest of their lives, right?
Wait, I never checked with any of my betting friends what the odds would have been on South Africa and New Zealand making the final in the first place. So that would have been, that was the other good bet I think that anyone could have had. But you're right. Like if you, so what would, I'm trying to think what New Zealand, probably before the toss in the test, they would have been about 10 or 15 to one. Maybe 8 to 10 to one. Mm. And I think New Zealand to win this tournament was somewhere between 10 to 20 to one as well. If, as a joke, you put on a couple of those bets, you would have done pretty well as a Kiwi fan. So hopefully there's someone out there and that person is awake and they are at a bar at 7:48.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, let's talk about South Africa a bit as well, of course. You know, they were really, really good throughout the tournament. They only lost to England in the group stages and then they annihilated Australia in that semi-final. It was a comprehensive victory for them as well. Look, it's a team in transition. We spoke about that earlier. Lizelle's not there. And of course, Shabnam Ismail has also retired. So big losses from the previous T20 World Cup final. But, you know, you've just got to feel for South Africa as a nation at the end of the day because they've lost three back-to-back-to-back finals in the T20 format. Mm. You know, two for the women and one for the men. And you feel more for the women because they did exact their revenge versus Australia in the semi. And they were the favourites to win this final. And they really should have as well, you know. Pound for pound, you take that team. But here they are, once again, you know, falling short right towards the end. And it can't be easy being a South African cricket fan at the moment.
Do you remember when we did the, I think I did a whiteboard video that we made a footmarks on, which was all about...
The choke one?
Yeah,
choke,
whether...
Choke,
where,
rain.
Which one was a choke? Yeah, rain
curse,
and...
Something like that.
All that sort of stuff. I was thinking about that while this was happening. Because there were some pretty big red flags in this side. So New Zealand came into this final as 270 outsiders, right? And I was just like, that is a ridiculous number. And the only reason I didn't bet on New Zealand straight away is because I just wanted to see if the ball was going to swing. By the time I went to bet on them, they did about three fours and they were already into almost favorites at that point, right?
Yeah.
But, and I was thinking there isn't that much of a difference between these teams. The New Zealand has obviously three stars, one aging star in Tuhuhu, and then a bunch of role players.
Yeah.
South Africa have four top order players and probably three, really, because, you know, Bosch has only played one innings, really.
Yeah.
But, you know, three top order players that are really, really good and then three bowlers. Like, if you think about their team that way, you start to go, how can they be a massive favorite over New Zealand? Now, they had played better cricket. I will give you, I would never argue that they hadn't played better cricket in this tournament. But that's why I thought it was interesting. The other thing was that New Zealand is a bowling team and South Africa is a batting team. And then that meant that it was strength versus strength, which I think that's the sort of thing that can help the team that isn't quite as good overall, right? Because, you know, you have your ability. If you can nullify that and you get enough role players to pick up, then you're in a really, really good position, you know, for the second part of the game, in this case, the way that the toss went and everything else. So I think it's probably fair to say that South Africa got the absolute best out of themselves almost all the way through this tournament. Even the game they lost to England, they almost stole that by just really disciplined cricket all the way through. I think they got the best out of themselves. And so because of that, I think we slightly overrate them. Whereas I think if you go through pound by pound, I think if you've got a specialist wicketkeeper who bats at number nine and doesn't face any balls through 90% of the tournament, it's probably not the most solid cricket team that you could have, right? And I think that's very fair.
This was made using MB Play's insights. What they have done for England and New Zealand test players, they can do for club cricket as well.
No, I think you make a fair point over there. And, you know, they had some positives, lots of positives, right? Laura Woolvard and Tasman Brits were phenomenal up top with the bat. They were really, really good and scored a lot of runs. And Malaba is a bit of a revelation, right? Because we didn't know she was that good prior to this tournament. And she has ended up with 12 wickets and she's won them some games. And that trio of Marizan, Malaba and Khaka was really working out for them, which kind of failed them in this one. And like, I'm just really sad for Marizan personally, because you could tell that she's really jolted by this and she's taking it pretty harshly. And even before, you know, that second innings, they were showing close-ups of her and she was like really feeling it. I felt like she was there and really wanted to win it. But unfortunately, you know, it doesn't always work out. And this was probably her final swan song as well. I don't see her playing another one, right?
Well, I mean, she might play another one, right? But they still have to get past Australia, England, India, New Zealand, West India. Do you know what I mean? So this, they did it. They slayed the dragon in the semifinal.
Mm-hmm.
They did absolutely everything they had to do to put themselves in a position to win it. And then they didn't have to play India or England in the final. They had to play New Zealand. So they would have had to have been in a position where they thought to themselves, we have a huge chance here. You know, I know I've just picked at their side a little bit, but I could pick at New Zealand's side a little bit as well. Like, the truth is that they had played, I think, the most consistent cricket all the way through the tournament.
Hmm.
They put themselves in a position to win. She may never be in that position again.
Yeah.
And that's the truth. And, you know, as happy as I feel for Susie and Sophie, I feel the same, the opposite for Marizan, because she's an absolute warrior, let's be honest. Yeah. Just an absolute, like, she's...
Proper athlete, competitor on the field, and she's done so much for this game, women's cricket, really. She's been a phenomenal, fantastic ambassador, right?
Do you know what? I was thinking about this the other day, and it's not in our piece, but we might end up doing a footmarks on her anyway. But when you look at it, there are a lot of all-rounders who are really, really great naturally, athletically, and talented, right? And so they coast through. She is that, but she's also absolutely a fighter and a warrior. Like, she's got that sort of Ben Stokes sort of thing of like, I just will, you tell me what needs to be done and I'm going to find a way to try and do it for my team all the way through. You know, and so those sorts of players, they wear this the harshest, right? She's going to think that she's let down the team. I mean, with the ball.
She was okay. She didn't strike, but she didn't go for runs.
Yeah, I mean.
What, 24, 25 runs, something like that? Can't be more than that.
Yeah, I mean, they stuffed around with where she bowled as well, of course, as we talked about before. She hit, what, one or two boundaries and then went out. You know, so look, I'm just trying to bring it up now. So, yeah, none for 25. So she went at 6.25 in a game where 8 runs and over was fine. And then she came in and she hit, one boundary, so 8 off 8. So she'll be frustrated with that. And she's played a lot better games than that, but you know, you can't be perfect every day. And that's probably the sort of thing that drives someone like her, right?
I mean, 2 back-to-back final losses in the T20 World Cup is not something that is easy to digest for the best of them. And we all know how passionate a cricketer Marizan Kapp is. And here's to hoping that we get to see her in another T20 World Cup, right? And at the end of the day, you know, both of these teams walk away with a lot of prize money, which is also a great revelation. New Zealand have made big bucks. I think it was, what, 2-point-something million US dollars, was it?
Something that's like how much we made for this podcast.
Yeah. But I mean, I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was quite, you know, handsome. And even South Africa, they're going to walk away with some money over here. But just overall, before we kind of end this, this has been such a great tournament. So many different upsets, like right from the start, if you think about it. Even Pakistan defeating Sri Lanka was one of those games where you were like, really? This has happened? Right? And then India lost to New Zealand, and it wasn't a close game. New Zealand, the only other game that they absolutely steamrolled the opposition in was that India game. And then it was the South Africa one.
4 teams in this tournament massively played beneath themselves, right? So Australia, England, India, Sri Lanka. You know, who are the big 3 teams who are most disappointed? It would be Sri Lanka. They're not even in the big 3, but they should be the most disappointed. They didn't win a single game.
Yeah.
And they came, they must be looking at this tournament now going, if we'd played our best cricket, we would have made the final and given ourselves a huge chance of winning this. And instead, they've been home for a week, right?
True.
You know, it's not been going well. Of the big 3 teams, the one who should be most disappointed is Australia, because they're the best team in the world. You know, if they had got through, they would have got a much, they wouldn't have had to go up against India or England either, right? Like, if they had got through to the semifinals, to the final, they would have been in a good position. I think coming into the semifinals, Australia were 130 to win the entire tournament. They hadn't even played the semifinal yet.
Yeah.
And they were already unbackable favorites, essentially, for the tournament. So I think that tells you how disappointing they were. India are probably the worst of the 3 if we're looking at it from a pure performance way.
I don't know, man. I think India, Sure, I mean, they lost that game to New Zealand, but then we saw some fight from them, right? Even the Australia game, they really took it close. So they were really out there competing. And when I look at Sri Lanka, I'm with you. Four losses out of four is not something anyone could have predicted. People were thinking that maybe they have an outside chance at the semifinal. So, and they're Asian champions. So them, I'll definitely put at number two.
Yeah.
Or maybe three, actually, because I agree Australia were favorites and they really should have won it. But I think England will be very disappointed. They had the conditions favoring them. They had three spinners who were world-class in Sarah Glenn, Sophie Eccleston and Charlie Dean. And Sophie Eccleston is, like we call her, like the Bumrah of women's cricket, right? And then, you know, they hadn't lost a game either before the one that they did versus the West Indies, which is also one of the major upsets in this tournament. And they were just knocked out because they weren't good enough in their victories, right, in a way. So, I mean, I think they have every reason to be very, very disappointed as well. They were my pick, my hot pick to win the entire thing.
They were. I mean, when it comes down to it, I think the truth is all four of those teams are going to be pretty gutted with how they've ended up. Just to go back on your point about the World Cup. So, I mean, halfway through this tournament, it was going to be remembered for drops.
Yes.
And that obviously wasn't the case at all. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a lot of close games, which is the one disappointing thing in this World Cup. There was the one in New Zealand a couple of years ago where every women's game came down to the last couple of balls was fascinating. We didn't get that this time, but we did get the semifinals we expected. We didn't get the finalists we expected. We didn't get the winner we expected. You have to be happy with a tournament that's done that. Drew says, was this another toss like 2021? No, it wasn't anything really like that. In fact, it was the opposite for the first half of the tournament. Mm. You actually wanted to bat first.
Yeah, especially in Sharjah.
And when the dew came in, it wasn't very strong and it seemed to help the bowlers by skidding the ball on a lot. And so it was impossible to bat at lights for parts of this tournament. And by the end, I would have said it was pretty even. I think that the dew had come in a little bit for New Zealand. And if it did, it didn't come in enough. Do you remember when Amelia Kerr hurt herself on the boundary fielding?
Yes.
If you watch, she skidded a long way. And that's one of the things you're looking for when you're looking for dew. How far does the fielder skid? You don't skid on dry grass, right? Yeah. And so, just little things like that. It was a fairly even tournament. The toss always plays a part in day-night games and night games everywhere. Like, there are going to be certain games where it did. But when it comes down to it, England, as you said, lost one game. I didn't think they were playing particularly well before then. Mm. Australia lost one game. India lost that early one and tried to fight back. And maybe Sri Lanka's the only team that maybe just from that first game, from the minute they went out to bat against Pakistan, it was like, this is not their tournament.
Yeah, it really wasn't. And, you know, it was a freakish tournament, very bizarre, but also remarkable and beautiful for that very reason. Like, we enjoyed it thoroughly. Everyone, I think, has dreamed of a New Zealand-South Africa final in cricket at some point, right? We got that this time. Of course, New Zealand now have two world titles, three if you count the World Test Championship. And two of them have been brought by the women. So the White Ferns are, you know, out-trophying the Black Caps, which is amazing. And
let's just finish here. Do you think this is the greatest day in New Zealand cricket history?
Oh, man, the World Test Championship is huge. I don't know.
It's weird. Tough. I mean, I don't know where I'd land on that as well. But the fact that they've won a World Cup and had a great win in Test Match cricket on the same day.
But that team had been doing it for so long, right?
I know. So, I agree.
Yeah,
I don't know what the proper answer is. And I suppose this is something for New Zealand cricket to, New Zealand fans to think about. But either way, you know, I remember in 2015 when the men lost and I wrote, this was New Zealand's greatest almost.
Mm.
And I remember a couple of New Zealand players reaching out and just saying, you know, thank you very much for this piece. And, you know, maybe one day. But there was like a resignation. Mm. In fact, I can say this now because he's passed, but Martin Crowe was like, he was so upset that night of that World Cup final because he said, that's it, Jared, I'm not going to be alive for our next chance. And he wasn't, right? And what happens next? They win the World Test Championship and they win a Women's World Cup. And
lose one on boundary count. So there's that as well.
They almost won another one. Yeah, they were everywhere. But I remember, I've said this about Sri Lanka before. Sometimes I'll say, you have to remember that Sri Lanka is not a big country and that, you know, they don't produce a lot of Olympic athletes and other things and everything else. New Zealand is an even smaller country. And yep. they do have more sporting athletes. And obviously they have rugby union and, you know, they have Lord of the Rings and, you know, Peter Jackson and all these different things.
Susie has played basketball for New Zealand in the Olympics, right? Beijing 2008. So
yeah, just to say, Susie Bates has gone up against the US women's basketball team and the Australian women's cricket team. About the two toughest things that you have to go up against in women's sport. She's gone up against both. But
and she has hands for buckets. So there's your basketball reference.
But, you know, you when New Zealand, it's incredible that New Zealand is as good as they are in cricket. It's not like an, or I was going to say island or two islands wide sport. Like there are little pockets and everything else. And so, you know, my video is very much about Susie Bates and Sophie Devine and what they've done. But Amelia Kerr is as good as she is because one family in New Zealand loves cricket. And so New Zealand have won this World Cup on the back of this one family's obsession with the sport as much as anything else. And it's those families, right? When you look at New Zealand cricket, it's the families again and again who band together and stand up, right? And, you know, we watch Latham today. His father was a test cricketer, right? Yeah. We watch O'Rourke. His father was a test cricketer. Like all these different players, you know, are related to other the players Bracewells. All the way through.
All the Bracewells.
Too many Bracewells.
Yeah.
And so when New Zealand wins, it really is something else. It's not just, oh, well, New Zealand's a cricket team, and of course they're going to win sometimes. They haven't. Their history is not getting silverware and getting trophies. And so getting this one today is absolutely huge. And I hope those players get, you know, I hope they celebrate this as long and as hard as is physically possible.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, everyone is happy when New Zealand wins something because they're just such a likable team and country. And, I mean, commiserations to South Africa, right? I feel the pain for them as well. Their World Cup trophy cabinet is still barren. But, you know, signs recently have shown us that we'll see them or continue to see them in finals. Hopefully. Otherwise, people will look back at this time and think that, ah, if they really just nicked one of those three, right? Because they've lost three consecutive ones. Anyway, let's go to the Super Chats. I think we just have one today from Anurag Sharma. He says, might be a dumb question, but what's bigger for New Zealand? The test win versus India or the Women's T20 World Cup? Well, the Women's T20 World Cup, it's a trophy. Yeah. They've won in India before, twice, right? This was the third time. That's an easy one.
Yeah, you know, and they got a pitch that suited them. Yep. You know, they got conditions that suited them as well, like in a couple of different ways. I don't think that takes away from that win because India stormed back and almost stole that game, right? Yep. So I think it's still a phenomenal win. But when it comes down to it, the ability to win a World Cup means they had to overcome all these different teams and all these different situations, get themselves into, you know, let's just go back to the semi-final. DeAndre Doughton hits, what, three sixes in an over against Tahuhu.
Yes. Yep.
And it looks like New Zealand isn't even going to make the final, right? Yeah. Like, that's what it looked like. And every different step of the way, they found someone to step up and get the job done for them. And I think it's just that, it's because of all that, I think it's a bigger thing. And it's not to say that beating India in India, if New Zealand go on to win this test series, which is unlikely, but now possible, right? If they go on to win this test series, it gets closer. But winning a World Cup, when it comes down to it, winning a World Cup is just such an important thing. And this is hopefully going to change women's cricket in New Zealand forever.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we've got another super chat. Faisal Ratani is saying New Zealand's population is less than Karachi or Mumbai. Yeah, I mean, they've got more sheep than people over there, right? That's the joke.
I see this sort of stuff a lot when people say it's less than Karachi or Mumbai and they pick Indies. I think it's less than Melbourne, right? It's certainly less than London. Right? Like, it's not, you don't have to go to some of these big Asian cities. Like, just Melbourne is not one of the most populous cities on earth, right? Melbourne, my guess is Melbourne and Sydney both have roughly the same population as New Zealand. Like, it is absolutely brilliant from that point of view.
Yeah. That is an interesting one, though. If India do lose this test series now to New Zealand, I would be really like, we should probably discuss this again if it happens. Which one's bigger? Because it gets a lot tighter.
I tell you what, we'll get Coney on and we'll ask him.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's really, I think that's a really interesting question because if you beat India at home now, right? I mean, we just did a whole podcast about how almost impossible it is.
Multiple podcasts.
Yeah. and I don't think anything we said was wrong. But if New Zealand managed to win, then that is just so huge, especially a New Zealand team. I mean, the women have just won a World Cup and we're talking about being in transition. The men are in transition. It seems to me that New Zealand cricket is at its absolute best when it's in transition. All this trying really hard stuff, they can get rid of that. All they need to do is have a little bit of shambles going on and suddenly they're at their best.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not someone who's into astrology or anything, but if someone is, let me know what New Zealand stars are saying, because everything seems to be aligning at this point. And anyway, congratulations to anyone who was watching from New Zealand. Go and celebrate today's victories, you know, crack open a cold one. That's going to be the end of this podcast. Just a quick reminder, you guys can go to goodareas.co and bookmark that webpage, and that can prove to be a one-stop shop for all the work that we do as part of this team, whether it be written content, videos, or podcasts. Thank you for your interactions. Thank you for your super chats, and we'll be back tomorrow, actually, with another Good Areas Live. That's all for now. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.